This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for listening to the Evening Edition. Now, I was never any good at science in school. Physics, biology, especially chemistry, just not my thing. But the kids these days, they've got so much more than just a big, ugly, purple book of chemia. They've got apps. Well, actually, they've got the world's first role-playing game that also teaches you chemistry. What's more, it's by Malaysians. Uma and Ezra speak with the creators of this revolutionary educational product and find out just what digital games like ChemCaper mean for the average Malaysian student. Check out that podcast once you're done listening to this one. Just make your way over to bfm.my and search for ChemCaper. The state of education in the country is a pain point for many Malaysians, and often the discourse revolves around systemic issues. We talk about quality and indeed even quota systems. And that's just for children who have the privilege of formal education. Now, this evening, we're going to explore the realities of the children who are less fortunate, children right here in Malaysia, but marginalised children that the system all but left behind. With us are Ananthi Rajasingam, CEO of Yayasan Chowkit, and also Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, founder of Yayasan Chowkit and prominent child rights advocate. Welcome, ladies. It's nice to have you here with us.
Thank you for having us again.
Hello. Now, the both of you, we know you work very closely with marginalised children in the country who are, well, pretty much all but invisible in the eyes of the system. So refugee children, undocumented children, and those with incomplete documentation, because you have, you know, half and half sort of thing. So I think we can start by framing this conversation. Tell us about, well, describe your work with these children.
We actually started off in Chowkit for the children, focusing on the children in Chowkit. As you know, there's a lot of stigma in Chowkit. You know, people put lots of labels on Chowkit in the community. So we started off for every child. And then in year 2010, we started a homeschooling program because we realized many of the refugee stateless children do not go to formal schools. So from the homeschooling program, we put in like basic literacy where we have maths, English, Bahasa and science, just to give them a basic tool so that they can survive and use those tools for once they, you know, grow up and become 18 years old. Currently, we have about 60 children now in our homeschooling program. And this project, like that we did, that we are going to launch soon, called KL Kitaja, is to actually be a voice for the children through photography.
Right. Yeah. I suppose we'll get to education specifically in just a little bit. But when you talk about marginalized children in the country, I mean, a lot of it comes down to basic needs, right? A lot of the time, there isn't even enough food to eat, let alone education. Yeah. So tell us about that.
Well, I think first of all, let's start with I think everybody will be on the same page if we say that, you know, all children have a right to go to school and have a family, have three meals a day, not go hungry, have a place to play. And as we know, that's not true for some of these children, especially if you're marginalised, like stateless and refugee children or Angasli children, for example, for different reasons. One of them is poverty. Chances are, in a lot of these cases with marginalised, with refugee and stateless children, their parents tend to be poor. It tends to be second or third generations in some cases, especially with statelessness and undocumented or partially documented children. They tend to all come from poor areas, tend to be not educated very highly, and tend to live from hand to mouth. You know, we can tell you different reasons why. The stigma of unwanted pregnancies, religious reasons, cultural reasons, politics. Politics, I think, plays a big part in it. Refugees, for example, they flee from countries. The misconception of who these people are. I think sometimes the deliberate misunderstanding of mixing migrant workers and people who've overstayed their visas with refugees and stateless. So there's all these different reasons why they're invisible. And just the whole idea that, you know, in Malaysia, we don't have these children. Everybody's fine. Mm. And it's not true.
You know, it absolutely isn't. And I think that brings us to this. You know, here in the city, it feels as though encounters with marginalised children are rare, or maybe to a degree we're conditioned not to see them. Where exactly are these children located? And where are their parents? Are we talking about city, rural areas? Where are they?
Well, if you're talking about Chowkit, for example, then it's obviously an urban issue. And you know what? I think people tend to want to look for dying, starving children, crying, dirty, with clothes torn. And the truth of the matter is that's not what you're going to see. Mm. They look like regular children. They act like regular children. You can't point out a stateless refugee or Malaysian children from one another.
They are regular children.
They are regular children. Yeah. And, you know, they speak the same language and they're not going to be dirty or crying if they're coming to our place.
Yes.
For sure. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing our job. You'll see them on the streets. You know, if you go to Chowkit in the middle of the night sometimes. I don't know if it's true so much now because I haven't been there at night nowadays in the last couple of years. But if you used to go there at night at 10, 11 o'clock at night, you'll see the kids running around in between, darting in between cars, playing badminton in the back lanes, playing badminton in between the shop houses. You'll see them and you'll know. And no one is going to come up to you and say, you know what, saya anak pelarian or refugee or saya tak ada dokumen. They're just like, saya nama saya, that's it. My name is. But again, that's their name and that's their identity. But legally, they don't exist. And that's not their name and that's not their identity.
Do you have a rough estimation by way of numbers involved? I mean, how many of these children actually fall through the cracks? How many are we talking about?
With refugee children, documented refugee children, there's about 30,000. Undocumented, they're expecting about slightly less, so maybe about 40,000-50,000. With stateless children, the numbers run anywhere. Well, they're saying between 300,000 to 500,000 stateless people. So if you're saying that, you know, let's just use our Malaysian figures for children. If you say 30% of them are children or 40% are children, that's a lot of children.
Yeah, it is.
So then orang asli children, etc. There's lots. And, you know, so, yeah, we're talking about big numbers here.
I don't know whether you can, you know, just generalize, but I'd like you to take us to the reality on the ground and, you know, what it means for these children to be undocumented.
I guess when you're undocumented, most of the children, they don't have their basic rights met. So even like, for example, when a child wants to go to hospital, either the fees will be very high or sometimes they call the authorities. So you're always on the run. And I think for children, basic things like medical attention, going to school, being able to go to formal schools, having a roof over their head, you know, those are the very basic things that they need. But when they don't have any documents or no identity or they don't belong anywhere, it's a bit harder for them to actually achieve all these services.
I'll give you a different perspective. Like I said, most of the children who are stateless and refugees tend to be come from low-income backgrounds. But in some cases like mine, for example, and this is a personal story, I've adopted a stateless child. And the fear that you have, not just when she goes out on a play date, you know, you don't know what's going to happen if there's a raid, God forbid.
Can she be arrested?
She can be arrested. She's got no papers. She has a bus with me. I actually go around when we go out of town or we go to Penang or we go to JB or Elvin. I actually photo set copies of her birth certificate. And her birth certificate has her name. So she's lucky in that sense, she's documented. But the part that says citizenship is Tiada Matlamat, which means no information. She's stateless. Mm. So I go around with that document when we go out of town. That's never mind. She also has really bad asthma. She's actually sick right now. She's been sick a lot of times. And I actually pray, yes, for her to get better. But I pray that she doesn't have to go to the hospital because every time you go to the hospital or if you, let's say, for example, she needs to get admitted, you have to pay a deposit. I'm not poor, but I'm not rich. I can't afford to do this all the time. And, you know, that's just like the physical access to education, access to health situation. There's the self-esteem thing. She's getting older. She just turned 8. And, you know, and it's very hard when people ask you like, okay, she's not your daughter. She's adopted. She has no papers. She has no, you know, where's she from? You know, and these are hard things for an 8-year-old to hear. And I think it's you have to realize and you have to put yourself in the shoes of a child to understand and get that perspective of what it feels like. And I think, you know, going back to the exhibition, that's what it is. Looking through the lens of a child and saying, this is my world and this is how I see things.
Have things changed over the past few years?
It's gotten worse.
Tell us what you mean.
I think it's gotten worse because the policies have gotten more strict. Mm-hmm. I think there was a beginning, there was a bit of a relenting, I think, to understanding that all children needed protection. And I think it's gotten worse. There is this, I don't know if it's deliberate, but there's definitely a collective effort to lump all children who are not Malaysian as being from foreigners. And that's not true, especially with statelessness. A lot of these children are born out of wedlock or abandoned or trafficked or you know, come from Orang Asli places. And there are so many issues to lump them together deliberately with another group of statelessness, like children in Sabah, for example, is so completely wrong, because there are so many categories of statelessness. There are so many different types of children who are all in need. So to lump them and say they're all Indian or of Indian descent or they're all from Sabah is so wrong and so irresponsible, I think, to do that.
Well, pick up in a little bit, but very quickly, when it comes down to it, why do you think we're dragging our feet? Is it because we don't care? Is it because we're selfish?
I think it's a political thing, one. I think it's a matter of money and responsibility. Malaysia has a reservation on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and access to education and right to identity. So if you don't acknowledge, you're not responsible. Right. Which is wrong. And we need to look at it. Because to me, and we've done the numbers as well, it makes more sense to build more schools than to build more jails. Because these kids aren't going anywhere. Right. So,
all right, we'll explore education in a little bit. Stay with us. This is the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station. I'm Caroline Oh, and this evening we're talking about the plight of marginalised children here in Malaysia, who and where they are, and what the future holds for them. With us is the CEO of Yayasan Chowkit, Ananthi Rajasingham, as well as Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, who is the founder of Yayasan Chowkit. So I think one of the most important influencing factors when it comes to anyone's future, obviously, is the issue of education and access to education. Mm. So let's go with that. I suppose as signatories of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, you were saying a little earlier, Tini, it says that we have a duty pertaining to compulsory and free primary education for all children. So tell us, what access to education exactly do these children have?
There's a reservation on that. Malaysia has actually put a reservation on that article because we don't provide free and equal access to education.
Okay, so what exactly does it mean when Malaysia puts a reservation on that?
It means we don't abide by that article. So we do not provide free and equal education to all children, only to Malaysian children.
We don't abide by it, but do we acknowledge that it's something that we need to achieve?
No. They will only provide education or allow education for non-Malaysian children on a humanitarian basis.
Right.
It's completely different from a rights basis, which means you do it out of the goodness of your heart, not because it's a responsibility and an obligation.
Right.
So it's very different, which means a lot of the education provided to children who are not Malaysian.
Usually
cases,
the children who are non-Malaysian, and so if they have access to formal education, they have to pay a big price for it.
Yeah, it's double or triple. And some of they get kicked out, the kids from school.
They get kicked out.
Yeah.
Okay, so what access to education do these children typically have?
Currently, they just
homeschooling.
Go for alternative schooling.
Mm-hmm. So you can't call these centres schools. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed. We don't provide schooling. We provide alternative education. So
there's no really accreditation. Like, you know how Malaysian kids, we can sit for exams and you get your O-levels and things like that. So when they sit for schools that are run by NGOs, we don't really, all we can do is like give them a letter. So it doesn't really carry much weight.
Right. Yeah. So as in, there's no certification or proper certification at the end of the day. Do these schools follow? Because, earlier you said that, you know, you teach them English, math, for example. Yeah. Do these kids, or these schools rather, do they follow any sort of MOE standards?
Actually, there's no control over most of the schools. That's why this KL Kita is part of our platform for advocacy. So, like YCK, we have our Child Rights Protection Guideline, where, you know, teachers have to abide. We have training for all the staff who run the centres. But that's what we are trying to advocate, where other alternative schools should be also having, like, you know, at least a basic protection. Children who attend schools, because there are a lot of, like, volunteers, you know, who might be molesting children, or no one is really keeping watch on those things. Mm. So, whether providing education, you need to see protection first before you actually provide them education.
So beyond Yayasan Chowkit, when we talk about alternative schooling, I suppose, tell us what the conditions are like in those sort of schools.
Some of the schools are really good. Yeah. Like, I think Dignity does a great job with the refugees. And I think they
Ideas
have like 800. IDEAS has one. Yeah. It's for children with autism. And they have the only secondary school for refugees
that follows
and
Cambridge
that follows
level.
The Cambridge level and looks at twinning programs with international curriculums and stuff. That's the only one. For us, I think as advocates on alternative education and just education for children in general, it has to be, for us, it has to be a quality education. It has to be something where I would want to send my child to. You know, and unfortunately, I'm not going to send my child right now the way it is. And we've got a huge waiting list, right?
Yep. And I think most of the parents also are illiterate. So they, like, for generations, they've never been to school. Yeah. So having a proper schooling, you have to, like, really prove to parents why it's important for a child to go to school if you want to break the cycle of poverty.
Is that part of your work, as in actually speaking with the parents and explaining why it's important?
Yes, it is a big part, because a lot of these children, especially, like...
The teenagers, they drop out.
Yeah, and sometimes they go into, like, child marriages. Mm. Mm. It's a cycle, you know, where the parents get married at a very young age, and then... they force the children to get married.
So 12 or 13 years
we've
old.
We've had kids who got married at the age of 14, 15. Yeah.
Yeah. And is it typical for this to go on for generations? I think you alluded to that a little earlier.
Yeah, we've got one. I met children whose parents, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, are all undocumented. So it's four generations. And yeah. So there's lots of that going on.
But what does it take for it to finally be resolved? Oh, we're talking about individual cases, though.
I will not talk about individual cases. I'm going to tell you one that I actually posted on Facebook, because this is, it happens. Mm. And so you forget education. Let's just talk about rights and children. So in one of the cases, a father who was himself stateless and found in a taxi, fathered four children. He was. He had a girlfriend, and he beat up this girlfriend, and he dumped the girlfriend on the doorstep of one of the hospitals, dying. They had four little kids. He decided he was going to sell them because he was a drug addict. He managed to sell one of the little ones, but he didn't sell the 8-year-old, the 7-year-old, and the 2-year-old. Long story short, the mother, who herself was stateless, body was lying in the morgue for a month because we had nobody to be able to claim the body and to bury it. And after a month, we decided to lie. I'm not going to say the hospital because they'll know. Mm. But we had to lie and pretend to be family members. We had to get people to be family members so that we could bury the mother. And at this time, it was a lot of drama going on. I mean, all children have no papers and stuff. The father had been arrested because... for trying to sell the 2-year-old. Anyway, the 8 and the 7-year-old were the ones who had to bury the mother in an unmarked plot outside Sepang. There's a grave site there for people who were poor with no these things. So he, with our staff, and the 7-year-old had to bury the mother. He couldn't even recognize who the mother was when he went to the morgue to claim the body. He said, "This is not my mother. My mother is fair. But the body had turned black because it had been there for a month." And that's how he buried his mother. That is a true story. And there are so many kinds of stories. They don't go to school. They get beaten. They get raped. They get murdered. They have no families.
It's terrible.
It's
multiple trauma because they don't
multiple.
Even see
you can't even. You don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
You don't even know where to start. The loss of a mother, burying the mother, the loss of a child, the loss of the father, being sold, being beaten. You don't even know where to start with these kids. It's horrifying. Horrifying that it happens in Malaysia.
You know, I do want to get back to education in a bit, but have there been any positive developments? So say for stories like that, I imagine that would be a very typical story.
Currently, we have one success story with one of the refugee children who joined our school. So now she's turned 18 years old. And we always try to figure out what happens with these children once they turn 18, because we only can provide services until they are 17, right? And then they become adults. So this girl actually, she volunteered to be one of our teachers.
Mm.
And now she's actually a full-time teacher within our homeschooling. And we are sending her teachers training through UNHCR program.
But one success story
exactly.
of 100.
But you know what?
One child
one,
at a time.
To us, our motto is every child matters, every child matters. We'll take one success at a time, because if not... we will go completely mental. The reason we do this job, not for money. We do this job because we really truly believe about rights of children, and we really, really care. And for us, I think every success matters, because we can always point to a child and say, look where they are, and use them as a beacon of hope for these children, because that's what they need, hope. I think...
We've had other children who've got resettled back to in the States, or so for them there's better opportunities there where they get to go to school. I remember one girl who told me she wanted to be a doctor when she was 12 years old, and I couldn't tell her the reality in Malaysia, you can't be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But now I still keep in touch with her on Facebook, and she told me she wants to be a doctor. So, and she's in US. So I guess, just the opportunity, giving a child, every child has potential, and giving them the opportunity to enrich their own lives, makes a lot of meaning to the work we do.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, covering marginalized children here in Malaysia on the Evening Edition. Back after the news, this is BFM 89.9. Well, you've made it this far, so you're clearly enjoying our program, which means you're clearly going to want to listen to more once you're done with this one. So go on and learn about the future, about using digital games to teach our students things like chemistry and physics and all of the stuff that you and I just couldn't wrap our heads around in high school. Just make your way over to bfm.my and search for ChemCaper. A very good evening to you. I'm Caroline Oh, and this evening we're speaking with Ananthi Rajasingam, CEO of Yayasan Chowkit, as well as Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, who is the founder of Yayasan Chowkit. We're talking about marginalized children here in Malaysia and the need for education. So we did get started on the topic of education a little bit earlier, and we covered the fact that, you know, these children basically only have alternative schools to go for, and that these alternative schools are nowhere close to even the kind of public schools that regular Malaysian children get to go for. Talked a little bit about their conditions. What would be the best alternative education for marginalised children, in your opinion?
Best alternative education is school choice. For us, I think if you talk to people like Ideas, who have the Ideas Academy with the State School for Secondary Kids, of the school for their stateless secondary kids and stuff, we'd say that, you know what, since we insist that children aren't provided with just, you know, basic education and they have to have the best education possible, what we have to do is to just put in resources to ensure and ramp up the quality of the education to ensure that these children get the best possible way. So we're looking at different kinds of models of education. So you're looking at things like what happens in America or in England, like trust schools, or, you know, Dutch curriculum for secondary school kids, or charter schools, etc. So there are so many different models. There'll be school choice. And the other good thing about providing and ramping up the quality of education for these kids and providing alternative education is you get to integrate Malaysian children who may not benefit from local schools or who want choice in terms of where they go to school to attend these schools, so that there's integration and there's more to know and more to learn and a healthier environment for learning and growing. And that's exactly, I think, the way what needs to happen. But on top of which, providing education and good quality education is for by itself and by definition in that way, a sense of it, there's a sense of empowerment of providing that voice for children to learn and know and to be able to articulate what it is they want for themselves, to be able to make choices and to provide opportunities for these children that they could never get elsewhere. It's so important, I think, to provide opportunities for children to make better choices in life. What are we giving children now who are marginalised, never mind stateless and refugees or, you know, or special needs, etc.? What are we giving our children? What are we saying to children, that if you're different, you don't belong, and through no fault of yours, you don't belong and you're out? What do we say, I think, as a human being or as part of humanity, that we say these children don't exist, they don't deserve anything better?
What are your thoughts on integrating them into the regular school system, if that were indeed an option?
I think it would be good.
That would be our first option, actually. For them to have access to, you know, regular schools and not just closing our eyes, you know, on these children. And I would say that I see all these children as children first, so we should not be like grading them into categories if we really look at them as children. And many people, I think the perception of, you know, Malaysians, like, they feel this is not your problem, or they always look at other countries where there's wars and things like that, but they don't see like what is just at their backyard is their problem, and they should be playing a bigger part in
this. We don't need to go to Palestine. We don't need to go to Syria. We've got Syrian Palestinian refugees here. We don't need to go that far. Just look at what's happening here, you know, 1 mile away, half a mile away. We don't need to go that far. Fix what's here too. I'm not saying anything, but I think compassion can start at home. You know, humanity can start at home too. It's good that you sympathize with what's happening abroad, and I think we should. But let's just be compassionate and cultivate humanity here and look at what matters here.
Tell us about the safety standards. It's something that you talked about a little earlier, the safety standards in alternative schools at this point. What are they like? Are there cases of abuse?
There are many schools that are not registered or not supervised. So they have, like, we don't even have, in Malaysia, we don't have a database of, like, pedophilia or, you know, like, sexual crime. So the volunteers who come into these schools, who are they? Like, no one really does a background check.
But these schools are set up by?
By NGOs or individuals, yeah.
Not all NGOs have child protection policies in their centres.
Right.
It's not standardised child protection policies. So sometimes they fall, you know, within the gaps, and they don't really vet through who's coming into the organisation. So we don't know what happens behind closed
doors.
So
you know the whole idea of taking home lost and cute puppies,
yeah,
or coming in and petting them and then going back? That's how children sometimes are treated when they go to NGOs. They're treated as, you know, petting zoos and stuff where you go in and you pat the child, or, oh my God, they're so cute, why don't we take him home on the weekend? You start correspondence or, you know, or some kind of communication, SMSs with children in the centres and take them home for swimming because you think it's a good thing. And then what happens? Who's
what
taking
responsibility? What happens to the child?
Sometimes bad things happen. Bad things. Sometimes they, yeah, because they don't have permission from the parents, perhaps, to be able to take these children home. What if the child swims or chokes? Or you know, there are so many things you can do. And what, God forbid, if they're pedophiles. God forbid.
We yeah. actually, like, last year, we managed to trace, like, help the police trace a pedophile.
Oh, there was this big case.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, no, you'll never know a regular person living in your backyard who is a pedophile. And because we don't have any database to track them down, they're just lingering around the neighborhood.
And of course, these children are far more vulnerable.
Yeah, much and more pedophiles vulnerable. Are very smart because they actually groom the children. So they give them money or they give Sweets. Them handphones and tell them, you know, if you're going to tell anyone about this, then you'll be in trouble. But they give you cash and so they sort of like,
groomed.
They groom them. And they do things behind where no one knows until, like, you know, like last year we found out
he molested
about 13 boys. And we worked with the police to...
But does it have to be something like that where you actually have to... You know, it has to be that kind of crime where you can work with the police before something like this is dealt with. What about, I suppose, mental torture and things like that that the children have to
corporal punishment. Corporal punishment. Let's just not go for corporal punishment in primary schools here. I mean, regular schools here as well. It happens, you know. We have to tell the teachers and stuff and parents and stuff, like, you know what, we don't hit. We don't hit children. We don't hit children in classrooms. We don't make them feel small. We don't belittle them. We don't, you know, So a lot of that, we don't have to go as far as pedophiles and stuff, but that's what happens. People coming in, stopping in, pulling children out, you know. No. There are rules. There are rules for children. We provide school uniforms for the kids. We set up a center that looks like a school. They are school children, and for all intents and purposes, and there are rules. But there's no corporal punishment. There's no, you know, there's no like, oh my God, let's just take it easy. You know, we can come to school when we want. No, there's no such thing.
And so, I suppose if given different forms of education or alternative education for marginalized children, who do you think should, I suppose, regulate these schools? Should it fall under the
Ministry
same
of Education?
Ministry
of Education still regulates these schools and provide licenses every year, I think, to be able to operate. So that's what they do for private schools, because these are private initiatives, so it falls under that group. Ministry of Education for sure, which would be nice too, because, you know, they're the governing body. It would be really good if regulate the schools and provides a license, because it acknowledges that, you know, that we do provide some kind of education for these kids, and, you know, it's sort of formal.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, a lot of conversation about these children who manage to go through formal education or any education is whether or not, well, formal education, is whether or not they'll be able to get a job and go to university and the likes. I mean, undergraduate employment is a big issue here in the country. Yeah. And that's for people who attend regular schools.
Yeah.
So what's it like for a child who goes through alternative schooling? What typically does happen? I mean, we're talking about generations after generations of statelessness.
Yeah. There are some universities, like Help University actually provides tertiary education for refugee children, stateless children.
Right.
But these universities sometimes have no access. They're not easily accessible. So already the children are poor and they can't afford like transport fees and things like that. So I guess the little initiative we have in Malaysia for them to go into tertiary, it's really challenging.
Yeah.
Or you go into vocational studies and stuff. I know the foundations, a lot of the big corporates and stuff are looking at ways in which they can work with children and to provide alternative education for them. But it's mostly for Malaysian children, not non-Malaysian children.
Well, while these efforts, I think, are extremely commendable, they seem very ad hoc and piecemeal, and, you know, it doesn't seem to be able to fill the gaps, really, where it's needed.
We're not also moving it fast enough.
Yeah.
We're just not educating all of them.
That's right. I mean, what do you guys feel, considering that you're in the field? Is there hope?
There's always hope. I think, you know, it was funny because I was just met one of your guests outside and we were just talking about, you know, alternative education, like studio schools and charter schools, and we were talking about all this stuff. And, you know, there are people concerned and there are, you know, I think there's more hubs for learning and growing and trying to figure out how to deal with the problem. I think it's a better situation in many ways because, no, I said it was for the children, but in terms of creating awareness and using it as an advocacy tool, mm-hmm. I think there is more awareness about the issue. I think there are more people willing to tackle the issue. The fact that, you know, that we're doing this in collaboration with the University of Malaya is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Academia hardly comes in, yeah. you know, and address the issue. So I think there's a lot of hope. And like I said, one kid at a time, one person at a time, you know, and if we can change one reader at a time and one person who's listening to your radio station at a time, that's what counts. It's one more than what we had yesterday.
And so once they're aware, what can they do? What can civil society do to us to help?
Oh, it's so funny. One of my friends just asked me that same question today. Like, what can we do? And I was like, buy exercise books, buy stationery, you know, come over, come talk, come tutor, come.
And I think it'd be good, like, to, you know, look out for, like, schools, alternative schools in the area. So, like, there's so many. There's one school in Pudu, there's a school in Imbi. So, if people can actually look out at their neighborhood and see if there's any alternative schooling, maybe they can provide books or sometimes fundraise for the school. Because I think a lot of NGOs, they really struggle with funding. These are the things that, oh, they can volunteer their time to be teachers. They can even contact like UNHCR and all. I think on UNHCR website, there's a volunteer opportunity. So they can find out from UNHCR where can they go and volunteer. Because most of the schools are governed under UNHCR.
The NGOs, some of the NGOs also provide centres of alternative education in Stapatslang and all these different places. So there are little NGOs doing this. But I think what's missing is that cohesiveness and that whole standardisation. That's what's missing.
Mm-hmm. And we really encourage like consistent volunteerism. Because yes, you know, when children see phases, they look forward to the volunteer coming back. So it'll help the NGO really if you volunteer on a very consistent basis.
All right. Yeah. Now, before we wrap up, one of the most important things we can give to these children is a voice, like we said, right? So that they become visible in the eyes of the people and, of course, the authorities who have the power to actually change things for them. You know, we also said that there are many individual efforts working together to bring about greater visibility. There's an exhibition that's going on right now.
We
talked about it very briefly, highlighting the plight of marginalised children. It's KL Kitaje. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, KL Kitaje actually was started by Professor Kamal from UM. So he came to volunteer with us 2 years ago. And from there, he had an interest in the homeschooling program. And from there, he gave them cameras and he taught them how to use, you know, digital cameras to take photos. Mm-hmm. But the children actually went out with their own camera phones and took pictures that were very close to them. So, for example, there's one picture of a child who took a photo of her own home. Like, it was, like, really shabby. And, you know, when people look at it, they ask us, like, is this a public place or is it someone's home? And then when they see the picture, they actually understand the hardship of the child. So, those pictures actually capture a lot of the feelings part of people, and Kamal also profiled the children so that there's a profile of them, and you know, like what the story, you know, what meaning they made out of the photos of the story. So that's how we changed it into our advocacy and, you know, gave it a voice so that it's more coming from the children and not us adults dictating. So yeah, this is going to be quite a exciting exhibition for us. In the exhibition, we have like, you know, photography, we have interview. We also have a documentary on Bakul Boys, which is showcases children in Sabah who sell plastic bags in markets. We also have drawing from one of our kids. So there's a few different elements to make it more, like, you know, exciting for us and for the kids and for those who are going to come and view it. So I hope everyone joins us for this exhibition.
All right. So it's happening at the Chancellery University, Malaysia, from the 2nd to the 31st of March. It's open from 10 to 10. And this is open to the public?
Yes. And it's free.
It's absolutely. Okay. So I suppose, you know, to that question, what can civil society do? You know, for now, go for the exhibition, learn their stories, see them. Is there anything else you'd like to add, ladies?
No. No, I think you know, we could go on. No, I think please just go see the exhibition. But also, I think, you know, I think we could practice a little more compassion and humanity and just understand and try to see things from a child's point of view, if nothing else. Just try to see what they see from their point of view.
Dr. Hatini Zainuddin and Ananti Rajasingham, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.